A couple of weeks ago, the influential monolith of the financial services industry stood in the way of healthcare reform and changing the incentives for energy spending to heal the planet. Now that monolith is reduced to rubble and begging our Congress to save it. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. What should be the deal? Our number toll-free, 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. Toll-free and a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Do we have a chance to rewrite the social contract now on Talk of Alaska statewide?
Today's program is underwritten in part by the University of Alaska, the home of award-winning faculty, students, and alumni, and offering 500 different degrees and certificates. Find one that's right and do something major. Information at alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. And by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state.
One of our favorite subjects is investment. What is a good investment? What's sustainable? What should we do with our permanent fund? Things like that. How does the financial services industry work? Well, it turns out it doesn't. we have just an absolute blizzard of information, and your participation is welcome at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. First up, Nobi Prinz, author of Other People's Money, and it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Nobi, how are you doing today?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on your show.
You're basically this is probably taking your breath away as much as anybody's. You've been writing on the financial services industry for years, and now you find probably a lot of the things that you were afraid of a couple of years ago are unfortunately all happening in a period of just a couple of weeks. It must be kind of weird.
It's insane. I left the industry. I was actually at Goldman Sachs, and before that I was at Bear Stearns, which no longer exists, which is odd. And I left to write as a journalist. I wound up writing this book, Other People's Money, where I talked about the systemic risks and the inability to understand the balance sheets of the books of these large and getting larger institutions and all the types of complex things that they were trading, and that this would not end well. And it's amazing to me. I don't know that I could have predicted what will now be, if it's approved, a $1.25 and counting trillion-dollar amount of bailout so far. The package that's being discussed today in Congress is $700 billion. But the losses that have stemmed throughout and the murkiness of the entire financial environment is really phenomenal. It's historic. And actually, when you're in it and working in it, which I was, you don't even really comprehend what the impacts can be of what you're creating. And then when you get out and look at it, and then when it actually comes to fruition, it's very, very scary.
It seems right now that it would be hard to counsel someone what to do with their money. We had Catherine Austin Fitz on about a year ago, and she said, invest in something hard and something real. I said, you're not talking gold, are you? She said, actually, that wouldn't be so bad. But the last group of people I counseled, I got them investing in drilling a well. My guest sitting across the table from me, Chris Rose, he invested his money in land, and he's kind of glad about it right now. If you put your money in the bank, you're looking at an incredibly minuscule interest rate that won't catch up with inflation. So the temptation is to put it somewhere else, but it turns out that maybe the corporations aren't being run in a sustainable way. And now we have all these weird debt instruments that nobody can even understand, as you pointed out. Where do you think people ought to be putting their money right now?
Well, you know, I don't know how available this is for everyone here, but I actually have put some money into the international arms of our bank. So, for example, Citibank has a bank in England, and there, the same bank, pays like 6.5% interest for just a regular savings account versus some very small amount here, which is partly because the dollar is so low, and so that if you're investing anywhere outside of this country in an insured bank, you can actually get a decent return, and that would be the only place I've put actual money. In terms of physical things, yeah, gold was definitely a good call, as of course with oil. But I would not touch the financial industry right now. There's so much talk in New York about, you know, trying to find the bottom and whether this is a good time and have stocks deteriorated enough. And given the fact that I truly do not think we have even uncovered a percentage of the losses that we will in the banking industry, I would not go anywhere near it.
So do you think Paulson is sort of whistling in the dark now?
I think he came up with the $700 billion number out of air because he would have to evaluate all the losses at all of the commercial banks, the investment companies, their relationships with insurance companies, and that is more than $700 billion worth of assets. So, I mean, I think he's just kind of picking a number. But it's the floor of the number, and he knows that because in the proposal, in the fine print of that proposal that's circulating today in Congress, there's actually a little section called Section 6, and what Section 6 says is that it's $700 billion at one time, which means that if the government, i.e. the taxpayers, i.e. us, purchase $700 billion of the most worthless assets off of Wall Street books, and those go and evaluate downward over some period of time to, let's say, zero, then technically this proposal allows for more buying of more worthless assets, which is how the savings and loan was actually bailed out. There was some trust created to buy that bad debt. And the trust started at $125 billion, and then it grew like it tripled basically over 6 years. So it's the same kind of language, but we're starting at a much higher level, and we're starting with more debt in general in the government, on the balance sheets of the Federal Reserve, and throughout the entire country. So we're starting at kind of a more precarious point with a higher amount of bailout with the same language that we used for the SNL crisis. So it's a little scary.
So we're talking with Nomi Prinz, author of Other People's Money and formerly in the financial services industry. Paulson's proposal went before Congress, and there's a great pressure to act on it, possibly within the next 2 days. The point people for the Democrats are Barney Frank and Chris Dodd. Are they basically in the position then, with the amount of information that is available to them, of building a levy, just throwing sandbags around to try and contain this money flow as best they can, and they're going to have to re-engineer something later on.
That's what they're setting themselves up for. I mean, don't forget when the $30 billion package bailout for Bear Stearns happened, that was kind of done on a Sunday night between the Treasury and the Fed. And
we're always getting Sunday night surprises.
Sunday night.
Yeah.
Sunday night is just the time when things happen in our public federal system. But the idea was that would contain, those were the words that were used by Mr. Paulson, that would contain this correction in the markets, and that by doing so, it would, you know, take the worst player out of commission. It would give what's remaining to J.P. Morgan Chase, which is a bigger bank and supposedly more structurally sound, only because it owns people's deposits. Banks are the only things with actually real money. And that's what happened. Of course, that wasn't the end because nothing was asked about the rest of the system. So when the Fed had to bail out AIG, the nation's largest insurance company, on another, it was a Monday, but it probably started having its discussions on a Sunday, for $85 billion. That was, again, the language was, well, we need to do this because without doing this, you know, the entire world will collapse. And the same thing is being discussed now. So the number went from $30 billion to $85 billion, so kind of tripled. And now it's kind of jumped from $85 billion to $700 billion. And all of these, yeah, they're all Band-Aids on the Titanic, because without really fundamentally changing it, quantifying the risk and then changing the system, it's all really just wishful dart throwing at the number that might work.
Wow.
Or blindfolded dart falling, which I can't play, but let's say you were blindfolded and playing darts at the same time.
Well, hey, what would be your counsel? I mean, I'm sure everybody's asking you now. What would you say to Chris Dodd? What would you say to Barney Frank? What would you say to the Republicans who were really more skeptical than the Democrats about what Paulson's brought forth? A lot of them, anyway. What can they do? I guess the best they can do is try and install as many safeguards as they can into whatever it is that they approve.
Well, there's two things I would say. Hold on a second with this. We need to rush before the world collapses thing, because you've done that twice, and that's only cost us more money. So what I would ask for, if I was Frank or Dodd or any Republican, or really Paulson, I would ask any of the institutions who I stand possibly ready to take some of their, you know, junky assets from, and say, I want right now, before you even think about getting any money, before we even approve money to give out to buy your junk, you have to tell us exactly what your losses are. We want you to itemize what it is you stand to lose, so that when we come up with an arbitrary number, it actually means something. And I don't believe that has happened. It certainly hasn't happened publicly, and it is public money that's being asked to foot the bill for it. So that would be the number one thing I would be asking in Congress, which it doesn't seem to be anyone is, because I wouldn't want to buy something if I didn't understand what it was. I wouldn't buy a car without knowing if it could drive. And I certainly wouldn't buy a car with an engine that I knew didn't work. You know, I would want to replace the engine. I would want to drive the car. I'd look under the hood. And I think that has to be where you start. And if you're in a negotiating position, supposedly, where there's an amount of money that is being urgently, quote, both Bernanke and Paulson requested, then you should be in a position to say, well, wait a minute, before I get out a check, I'm not even going to talk about what I'm going to ask for in the future. I want to know right now what I'm buying. And please explain that to me. So that would be the number one thing I do. And then based on that, one should be able to figure out what has caused that risk and regulate those securities which are not regulated that have caused that risk and have that be a condition of passing the package.
So you're looking for a better diagnosis, it sounds like. And that could be really hard to come by, because the fact of the matter is, I don't know if there's a dozen people in the whole country, in the whole world, that really understand some of these complicated derivative financial instruments that these entities would be involved in.
Well, then, at the very least, before they all take a crash finance course, though, it's important to ask what the loss really is, to get a number, to get some clarification and some breakdown. Because even if you don't know how to structure some weird complex derivative thing, I mean, I don't know how to build a car, but I could figure out, you know, where to put the oil, and if something wasn't sort of working, how to at least ask someone who knows to fix it or do some of it myself without knowing how to put it together from the bare bulk. And I think that's what they really, and it is hard. It's absolutely hard. But when you've already committed, between Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and AIG and Bears, if you've already committed $500 billion and you're about to commit another $700 billion, and your proposal has no floor to what you can commit after the $700 billion, then you do have to do the hard work. I believe that on both sides of the aisle, it's their responsibility to do some of the hard work. Maybe they don't have to build the securities themselves, but they should understand the amount at least, and how that amount came to be at risk, so that they know what it is they're being put on the hook for, because actually it's we who are being put on the hook for it.
Nomi Prince, can you stay with us another couple of minutes and take one of our calls here?
Certainly.
All right. Guy in Valdez, you're on Talk of Alaska.
Well, I just want to say that it's both the Democrats and the Republicans that have gotten us in the mess that we're in. Back when Clinton was president, and deregulation, you know, get that big government off our back, and you see what's happened from that. But I want to draw similarities to what's going on with what happened back in 1929. And there was a point where J.P. Morgan and a bunch of these other Wall Street guys tried to stop the market from going down. And for a week, they threw money at the market. And they might as well have just burned the money, because the market crashed anyways. And for them to say $700 billion with as you two have been talking about how complicated this thing is, and with all the money trails and everything, and how much this is going to cost, we're going to be taking that money and throwing it away, because there's going to be a lot more money. And now they're going to be creating this money, and I want to know, you know, all of this foreign money that's been keeping our economy going so far is not going to come back here. Nobody's going to want to play with this country anymore, because our money isn't worth anything. And that's the scary thing. And you telling people what to do with their money, I'm telling everybody I know, start stockpiling food, because that's where we're headed.
Some people are. All right, Guy, thank you very much. Nomi, I know that you were for quite some time deplored the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which allowed basically the banks and insurance companies and so forth to become the same entities.
Well, yeah, and I think your caller is actually right too, because the 1929 crash, which preceded for 3.5 years of a Great Depression. And the idea that the speculative companies on Wall Street and the ones that are connected to regular consumers, regular individuals, should not play in each other's yard. And the idea of the Glass-Steagall Act was to separate the two. And yes, it was a total bipartisan over years, and culminating in the 1999 repeal of that act, that made it such that the lines between what could be used for speculation and who was speculating were completely dissolved. And so you have a situation where a bank can go to borrowers and extract, you know, subprime or adjustable rate or all sorts of weird mortgages and all sorts of different types of loans. And then that money is used as fodder for a lot of different kind of complex trades that weren't regulated on their investment banking side. And rather than, and that's the crux of this entire problem, which really isn't being discussed as its solution. And that's really, that's part of the problem. And foreign governments, and again, this is part of the reason our dollar is weaker, foreign governments and foreign central banks notice this. I mean, this is a real problem, and it's created real debt in our country, and it's created a lower currency and buying rate for our dollar, and that's why it needs a complex solution more than buying up the very assets that nobody understands to begin with.
So do you think it's in the cards that we could get some form of re-regulation? I mean, it would seem that it almost has to come, whether Congress realizes it yet or not.
I think, unfortunately, it's going to come naturally, but in a very painful way, I believe. I don't think Congress is going to get there. There's like one senator, Senator Dorgan, who has actually brought up the evolution of Glass-Steagall and the Great Depression and what happened then and why it happened and why it should happen now. But it's a voice, and he actually voted against the repeal in 99, et cetera. I don't see that being in the cards, unfortunately. I think what will happen is we've created these really, in the aftermath of the current wave of destruction in finance, we have bigger institutions now. As opposed to dissecting them and making them smaller and making them understandable, the Fed gave Merrill Lynch to Bank of America. That creates a huge investment bank and commercial bank entity in the very period where no one understands what it is that's on their books to begin with, and will make it that much more difficult to understand what's going on. It completely goes in the complete opposite of what Glass-Steagall meant, and it takes us back to the pre-Great Depression environment with bigger institutions. And I think these will collapse. Maybe not all of them, but we will see another wave of these bigger conglomerates have tremendous write-downs over the next year or so, and I think that one or so will go under, and then they're going to have to decide to take out the speculative bits or do something. So I think it may happen in a piecemeal way that will be very painful, and I don't know if it will ever get a legislative act, but I think it may just happen in a default, well, no pun intended, you know, in a by default sort of way.
Right. Okay, well, I want to thank you for being with us, Naomi. Nomi, sorry.
Thank you very much.
All right. Nomi Prince is author of Other People's Money. Fascinating conversation. Sitting across the table from me and just dying to start talking here is Chris Rose of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. Chris, welcome to Talk Alaska. Welcome back.
Thanks, Steve.
You were basically deputized to help the utilities of Alaska move into a renewable energy future. Would that be a good way to put it?
Well, I wouldn't call deputized, but you know, I did put together a coalition called REAP that is utility companies, environmental groups, consumer groups, businesses, native organizations that all want to do that, all want to have more renewable energy development in the state.
Well, we're at the point, as I understand it, where it's going to be necessary to invest in electrical power generation, and it seems to be no end of controversy as to what the fuel ought to be, what ought to turn the turbines. And now, of all things, we actually have a company, I guess the third time somebody is actually looking and put down money on Mount Spur to actually look at harvesting the temperature off of that mountain. And when you look at the map, you see that it's not too far from the Beluga generators and so forth, that over there on the other side of Cook Inlet from Anchorage, we have the potential, I would think, for a very interesting energy complex.
Well, that's definitely right. And I think in the context of this conversation, you know, what we ought to be thinking about are hard assets. And, you know, infrastructure, especially energy infrastructure, is something we all have to have a sustainable economy, to have an investment atmosphere where people want to come and do business. If you've got stably priced energy, which is what renewable energy is, you're going to attract investment. We've got, as you mentioned, many different resources over there, and the oil and gas lease sales that have occurred in Cook Inlet have not made as much money as this last Mount. Some of them have not made as much money as this last Mount Spur geothermal lease sale, which is very exciting. The state made over $3.5 million. We have a really competent developer called Ormat from Reno, Nevada, who won 15 out of the 16 tracks. But that's just one of the resources. There's also Lake Chacachamna Hydro over there. There's wind potential over there. There's going to be tidal potential as that technology matures. And all of them, as you say, are close to the current station where most of our electricity comes from, and that's Beluga over by the Beluga gas field. So it's a pretty easy transmission link to potentially all of these different resources over there. And I think that folks are thinking about our future and how we're going to leverage a lot of the money that we've got right now into some kind of a future for ourselves.
I've been told one of the problems with wind energy is that it doesn't necessarily make the energy when the load is there. That, and obviously that means it can't be as what they call base load. And people are a little nervous about it as peak load.
Well, the thing about wind is that it's a variable resource. But when you have a grid like we've got, a very modern grid, you can integrate wind. The Danish have up to 20% wind in their grid right now. And sometimes when the wind is blowing one place, it may not be blowing another, but there's still wind coming into the system. One huge advantage we've got here on the rail belt grid is the hydro we've got, because the hydro doesn't have enough capacity to run 100% of the time either. And so when you have the wind blowing, you can actually pool water at places like Bradley Lake, increase its capacity, and it kind of acts like a battery for the wind energy. So you use the wind energy when you've got it immediately, and then you can store energy in the form of water behind, in lakes like Bradley Lake.
And I guess ultimately then you reduce your fossil fuel consumption as you are able to use these, combine these other sources. Is that the idea?
Well, that's right. And I think most people would say that we've got to do all this stuff. There's really not going to be one silver bullet. We've got to do a lot of energy efficiency, and then we've got to do as much renewable energy as we can and wean ourselves off of the fossil fuels, because those fuels are subject to world commodity market prices. And we can be the biggest oil and gas producer in the world, and we're not necessarily going to be able to control that price.
You got to stop talking with your hands there. Bad for the microphone. Well, the reason that I invited you onto this program is because we're talking about investments. And I don't think you get to there from here without investing. So the question is, where does it come from? Does it come from the ratepayers? Does it come from the government? Does it come from the permanent fund? Where?
Well, there's a lot of different options. Mount Spur, for instance, would be an independent power producer. That would be a private company that comes in, that develops it, develops that geothermal field and then has power purchase agreements with the local utilities. The same is happening right now with the Fire Island Wind Farm. That's a private developer who wants to sell power into the grid. If we do some of these big hydro projects that are being considered, for instance, Lake Chocachamna or even Susitna, it's pretty clear that the state may have to step in, especially with Susitna, and actually buy down part of that debt for that project to even get into the bond market, if we have a bond market.
Yeah, right.
You know, we did that with Bradley Lake. The state paid for about half of it. And then
I mean, my money, I would just assume was in municipal bonds right now.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. I mean, that seems to be just a paradise of an investment compared to anything else right now.
That's right. And, you know, they could issue revenue bonds for those projects, but they're not going to be able to issue revenue bonds for the entire amount. So some of that money, if we do the big hydro, is likely to come from the state.
Yeah. So how would let's say the permanent funds, oh, gosh, you know, we're the stock market is lurching around and even our real estate is not doing real well. We believe in being divested and maybe we should look a little bit more closely at some of these renewable energy things. And so they decided to do this. How would the fund's fiscal managers be assured that they were going to get a return on their investment? When you put out bonds, you know what interest you're going to have to pay on those bonds. And so when someone loans money in terms of bonds, they know what they're going to get. They just clip their coupons or whatever, you know. What would it be for some public funding entity like the permanent fund, hypothetically, of course?
Well, yeah, I don't think we're there yet with the permanent fund.
No,
yet.
I don't either.
But, of course, with energy projects, you have the ratepayers paying rates. That's basically what backstops your revenue bond. And so people are going to be paying electric rates. And the nice thing about any of these renewable resources is that you know that the fuel price isn't going to go up ever. So the amount of money that the ratepayers is paying for that power is actually going to be pretty flat. And payable. Those ratepayers are going to be able to afford it. They're not going to have to worry about gas prices. Now, if a public entity funds a fossil fuel project, you don't have that certainty because the fossil fuel that funds the generator or that fuels the generator may continue to go up in price, will probably continue to go up in price, and therefore at some point maybe people stop using that electricity or using that heat because they just can't afford it anymore. So we're not there with the permanent fund yet, but you know, with this financial crisis that we've been discussing today, I would hope that the people who run the permanent fund would really start taking a serious look at what's this permanent fund worth to us if the financial system in which it is invested starts to go down.
Telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. We're talking about investment, and we'll bring in yet another guest later on in the show. Let's go to Norman now, joins the program from Haines. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Norman.
Yeah, good morning.
Hi. What do you say, Norman?
Oh, what do I say? I get to talk. Oh, well, I'm looking at all this world economy and everything going on and collapsing, and I've basically been focusing on my local economy the last decade, investing in local real estate, local business ventures, and local infrastructure, community foundation we have in Haines, and working on investing in our kids in the schools and education and new schools, new libraries, things like that. We've been working in the community. A lot of people, I like to think the world will pass us by, but we need to work on where we live.
So,
back into that.
So I guess you're feeling pretty good about that investment today.
Well, the school's still standing. It's the best library in the U.S. voted a few years ago and things like that. And granted, it's getting colder, and I'm out fishing right now and waiting for the fish to hit. But I just thought I'd call and say, you know, it's I'm focusing more locally than the whole world. It's my world. And I don't want to have to move again. I'm not going to retire somewhere else. I need to, at 48 years old, I've grown roots.
I agree with Norman. And that's kind of the reason that many of us individuals, and I'm not speaking for REAP right now, but many of us individuals like myself often wondered, well, why isn't the permanent fund being invested more in the state of Alaska? It's being invested in Wall Street and who knows where else. And now we're seeing that a lot of those investments were not understood by the people who actually bought and sold them. And so I think bringing it back to reality, bringing back those resources, because we start out with a hard resource, that's oil. Then we're trading it for something that's a soft resource. I think we should probably be trading some of that back into hard resources like you know things like commuter rail and wind farms and so on.
All right. Norman, we'll let you get back to your fishing. Thanks for calling.
Okay, I'll pull the net and see what we got.
All right. Thank you very much. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
9 out of 10 of Alaska's boating fatalities are adult males. Most drowned following an unexpected fall or capsize into cold water. Cold water can kill the unprepared, regardless of swimming ability. Wearing a life jacket can make the difference between life and death. Make your family's boating memories good ones. Always wear a life jacket when boating Alaska's cold water. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
So as anybody that goes to a brew pub knows, when you tap a new keg, you get a whole lot of foam out of it. It turns out that our investment climate has had a whole lot of foam on top of it. Investments that nobody even knows what they were. Computer trades based on the future guesses about things. The difference between this and gambling, I don't know if there is any. And all this froth, it looks like, is going to get blown off because there's a huge meltdown in the financial services industry. Congress is going to have to be called in to do a bailout that, as we heard earlier in the program, is definitely getting up into the trillions. And we're talking about investment today and sustainability and maybe even investment in sustainability. Chris Rose of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project is with us and joining us by telephone. Is Bracken Hendricks of the University of Massachusetts Amherst. How you doing, Bracken?
Very well, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's
and I'm with the Center for American Progress in Washington D.C. and we just did a study with the University of Massachusetts.
Okay. And this study has made the news all over the place, and is I think becoming an issue in the election. And this study is about something called green jobs. And I guess in the interest of disclosure, the Center for American Progress probably supports more Democrats than Republicans, wouldn't you say?
We do. We're progressive policy, but we don't support any political party. We're very, very specifically nonpartisan. We do advance progressive economic policies. They tend to invest in people. They tend to invest in infrastructure. We work closely with folks on both sides of the aisle, but we are more progressive in our leanings.
Were you surprised by the results of this study? As I understand it, this study demonstrates what many of our callers on Talk of Alaska for the last 2 years have been saying, which is if you invest in renewable energy, in things that help heal the planet, you can actually generate jobs off of it. It's actually a good investment.
Yeah, and actually we started this study obviously before the whole recent collapse in the financial markets, but I think that if anything they just strengthen the findings. We were quite impressed with the findings that we produced in this study. We really wanted to look at the potential for a green economic development strategy, a green recovery strategy, what the potential was to stimulate growth. Because certainly if we need to solve global warming, if we need to break our dependence on imported oil and move to new, clean, diverse, and more efficient sources of energy, that can mean a huge amount of investment. And that can mean investment in infrastructure, in a better quality of life by investing in energy efficiency that cuts your home heating bills and your home electric bills. But we weren't really sure by how much, and the results were quite striking. We compared investment in a broad-based package of renewable energy and energy efficiency, looking at wind, solar, advanced biofuels, retrofitting homes, investing in freight rail and transit, and then a modernization of the grid to make it more digital, a sort of a smart grid, they call it. And what we found was that if you compared, we looked at an investment of $100 billion spread over 2 years. To put that in perspective, the last economic stimulus was about $168 billion, and that was spent, you know, over a period of months within a year. We wanted to look at a slightly slower recovery package where that money got invested between 18 months to 2 years. And we found that it created 300,000 more jobs than simply giving it to consumption for stimulus. And that's because it's more labor-intensive. You're investing in skilled craftspeople to do investments in homes, more infrastructure. There's also more domestic content. If you just give people money and a check to spend on consumption, about 22% of that money goes into imported goods, you know, may come from China or overseas. If you spend it on infrastructure and helping people weatherize their homes and save on their energy bills, only 9% of that money leaves the economy. It stays locally in your community by investing in carpenters, by investing in new manufactured goods, by investing in, you know, very concrete, real investments. And when we compared it to if we took the same $100 billion and spent it on oil, it was four times as many jobs were created, 2 million jobs created from a green recovery package. If you spend it on oil and traditional energy sources, about 500,000 jobs would have been created. And these are not only more jobs, but they're better jobs. There are significantly higher numbers of jobs earning $16 and above, as well as more jobs at all ranges of income. So it was really quite an impressive finding, and it encouraged us that instead of the sort of economic activity that's based on speculation that's now blowing up in our faces, a systematic strategy to reinvest in our communities, reinvest in our built infrastructure, really can yield tremendous benefits in terms of long-term stable jobs, savings for consumers, and of course all the benefits from increased consumer choice and getting off oil and the environmental benefits that come with that. So it was an encouraging report.
All right. Bracken Hendricks of the Center for American Progress worked with scholars at the University of Massachusetts Amherst on the Green Job Study. Chris Rose of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, he just talked about smart grids. What can you tell me about smart grids?
Well, I'm not an expert in smart grids, but I do know that those are being discussed all around the country now. There's a huge movement to get more out of our grids. Right now, they're working very inefficiently in most of the country, and we can't add capacity, whether it be renewable or non-renewable, unless we, as Bracken was putting it, you know, digitizing them, making them work with each other, so that there's more of a computer-related relationship between the different places that are, you know, putting power into the grid and consuming power. And this is something that we have to invest in. In our grid here in Alaska, we not only don't have a quote-unquote smart grid, we have a fairly weak grid. We've got one line between Fairbanks and Anchorage and on down to Homer. That is somewhat susceptible to all kinds of environmental issues, you know, whether it be an avalanche or something else that might happen. So the grid system and getting the most out of it really does help the efficiency of your whole system.
All right. Let's go to some more callers. You ready to take some calls here, Bracken?
Sure. Glad to.
All right. Jim joins the program from Bethel, Alaska. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jim.
Well, hi there, guys. Really, my question, it's a prediction and a comment and a question that is probably for your first guest there. That it concerns investments for the average guy. You know, those of us with an IRA or some state retirement accounts. And my prediction is that this is the greatest wealth destruction era since the Great Depression. You haven't even talked about $900 billion we've spent on the war to date, the $25 billion on the mortgage buyout, and now, of course, we have this $700 billion. So I think bad times are just coming. I see really only one prudent investment, and that's my question, is what do you think about Treasury inflation-protected securities? Just came out last year with the U.S. government. They're supposed to hedge inflation. That's my prediction, is that's really the only prudent investment. My question is, and I'll sit back and listen, is, well, what do you think? Thank you.
Okay, Jim, I don't know if we have too much expertise on that left on the show, but I do know there was a point late last week where people were so desperate to shelter their money that they were investing them in government securities, overnight government securities that actually only promised to give him back the same money, pay no interest whatsoever. It was bid down to zero interest. I had never heard of such a thing before, but this actually did happen. So as you heard there, Bracken, our caller was basically suggesting, well, maybe government bonds need another look as an investment.
Well, certainly, you know, this is a time of you know, real risk in financial markets, you know, as you say, people are looking around for the most secure investments available. Clearly, access to credit, access to financing is very important from the perspective of business growth, and as capital markets dry up, it's a very dangerous time for businesses. One of the things that we look at in our study is emphasis on investing in new energy systems and retrofits and so forth can actually improve access to capital and improve investment in construction. We've seen a destruction of about 800,000 construction jobs with the slump in the housing market. The potential is there if we are smart about investing public resources in infrastructure and really helping to build the market for energy efficiency, that this can actually be a bright light in the construction sector. There's an opportunity by addressing our energy insecurity to drive new access to capital for these small businesses, for these larger firms as well, and to help homeowners make investments in upgrading the building stock. It could be a very important infusion of new economic activity in this sector. I also want to point to a very important, I think, example for all of us to be looking to is the experience that Japan had some years ago. They had a complete collapse of the bubble in their real estate sector. There was a very major housing bubble that collapsed. There was just a massive erosion, over 50% erosion in housing property values, and during that time, they systematically invested in infrastructure, and they were able to protect against slippage in their GDP. And so there is a way that we can actually sustain the larger economy overall by investing intelligently in infrastructure, using public investment to help drive new economic activity at these periods of downturn. It's when we really need smart public policy the most, and with the crisis that we're having around energy security, I think there's plenty of reason to focus in this area.
You know what suddenly popped into my head is the Highway Trust Fund. That we're seeing like people McMansions may have to be turned back into farms because nobody can afford to pay the mortgage. Nobody can afford to live there because it's too much energy cost to go to the office or whatever, and telecommuting isn't going to get there. Ain't going to get there. So I'm just wondering how many more roads we really need to build. And here's all this money that is being paid in the form of fuel taxes by Americans all over the country, enormous amounts of money.
Well, you know, a good example of a way to get around that is what's going on in Europe with a massive investment in mass transportation there. They've spent a lot – people over there have been used to spending a lot more money on gasoline for quite some time, and a huge chunk of that money has been going into taxes that the governments over there have been using for mass transportation. So when oil has been going up precipitously lately, they've been feeling it a lot less over there, not only because it's a smaller percentage of the total that they're already paying, but also because they've got these investments in mass transportation that they're able to use to get to work.
That's Chris Rose, the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. Go ahead, Bracken Hendricks.
Yeah, the flip side of that is the pointing to the Highway Trust Fund is actually a really important lesson, though, because it shows the kind of economic development that can be stimulated by public investment. We pursued the interstate highway system for national security reasons so that we could, Eisenhower, it was part of his vision of being able to move, troop deployments and equipment across the country, and it created this network of exchange, and it created ease of mobility. It was all built around cheap access to energy, and we're starting to see a limit on that supply of cheap energy. But smart public investment created tremendous value in terms of economic development, the growth of cities, a whole range of things. The problem is we didn't have real diversity. We didn't have, you know, investments in our rail system, investments in regional transit. There's a whole host of things we need to do as well, especially in light of the fact that we are, you know, hitting a limit to our access to cheap and abundant energy. We need to use it more efficiently. We need to use cleaner energy. But as we do that, we can look back to periods like the railroads, the canals, the highway system, and recognize that when we invest as a government, when we have, you know, national leadership that says we're going to get this done, we can unleash tremendous creative potential, tremendous economic activity, and there's no reason to believe that, you know, solving our energy crisis today isn't going to unleash the same type of activity, but in the field of clean energy.
Yeah, and I can hear a bunch of
investments. That's where I'd put money.
Right, I can hear a bunch of listeners right now saying, "Why, that's socialism." Certainly, that's been proven that that doesn't work because it's all run by government bureaucrats, and they don't know how to run anything. They don't know how to run any business. I can hear that.
I would say to that that, in fact, this is pure market. I mean, markets thrive when public investments take place. They're an enabling condition for markets to grow. It was investments in these sort of transportation infrastructure that sort of shared the costs and allowed businesses to focus and specialize. And you know, that really is at the heart of the growth of the American economy and the American middle class.
All right. Fascinating. Investment sustainability, the subject on Talk of Alaska, always a lively show. The telephone number toll-free across the state is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and you can email us at talk@aprn.org. And we'll be back in just a moment as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Let's go to Alex, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Alex.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. Go ahead, Alex.
Okay, I had a comment and a question.
You go right ahead.
The comment was on renewable energy in Alaska. I wonder why I haven't heard much about geothermal, because I heard in Iceland that the ingredients they needed were volcanic activity close to the surface and seawater, and they could get just about unlimited electricity, enough to sell to every industry and then pretty much give the people the leftovers.
Well, I could try to handle that. This is Chris Rose. We mentioned geothermal earlier in the show. Mount Spur, which is a volcano about 80 miles west of Anchorage, is a great possibility for geothermal for the rail belt. DNR just leased a huge chunk of land over there to some developers who are going to be exploring that. And you're right about Iceland. They do have a huge amount of their energy coming from geothermal, almost 100% of their heat and about 20% of their electricity. But as with all renewable energy, it attracts investment because it's flat-price power. And so right now, ironically, they are shipping bauxite from Australia to Iceland to make aluminum because the Icelanders can offer them fixed-price contracts for 20 years. And there's no way you can do that unless you've got renewable energy that doesn't have a fuel price increase.
I think we should also add that there has been quite a bit of talk about geothermal, Alex. It's more a question of it takes a while to get the hardware in place. I think the hardware even exists. And thanks to the work done at Chena Hot Springs, people are even looking at much smaller thermal differentials in the Earth as potential sources of energy now. Places in western Alaska where there's just warmer spots in the Earth's crust that they think they might be able to harvest that energy from.
Right. And, you know, there are lots of places with geothermal, but they're not necessarily next to places where people live. And so the transmission issues still exist.
Yeah. Alex?
I also had a question.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say there's been some really exciting stuff as well with new technology for geothermal, where they dig very, very deep wells and actually fracture some of the rock and inject water down. And geothermal is a technology that's growing incredibly, and they're finding more and more new applications and ways to use it. So I think you're absolutely right to be excited about it, and it's a smart baseload resource that makes a lot of sense in a place like Alaska.
Alex, you had a comment as well.
I had a question, yes. My question is to do with the PFD. Of course, I was born and raised in Alaska, so the PFD has become a part of our culture, and maybe not the best part in that it does kind of teach us dependency. But at this point, I can really only see two ways to go, and that is either the government gets it, and both Republicans and Democrats in Alaska have been talking about using the permanent fund for years, or we give it to the people, and why not let them decide what to invest it in? I keep hearing terms like public resources, public investment, public policy. All that really is doublespeak for taking the choice away from the individual and giving it to the few who feel like they can manage everything better. Why not just give it to the individuals and let me decide if I want to buy a windmill because I'm windy and Healy, or I want to buy a solar because I never have any clouds, or I want to buy geothermal because I live in the hills around Fairbanks and I can tap the water. Why not let individuals decide and not always go to public, because that really is communism.
So basically, you'd like to just cash out your $30,000 or $40,000?
I've got five kids. Break it up, and we will never have to ask the government for another thing till eternity.
All right. Thanks, Alex.
All righty.
Great thought. Let's go now to Tom, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tom.
Hi, Steve. I've been researching renewables for several months now, and I'm just starting to get into the Alaskan energy policy debate, and here's what I found. We're about to jump off of a cliff for the next 40 or 50 years on whether we're going to go into renewables and an all-electric society on the rail belt, or we're going to go into natural gas with the $3 billion bullet line to the North Slope, or minimally to the gas line as it crosses through Fairbanks. And I found out that about two-thirds of our generation capacity is now 30 years old and
right.
will be replaced within the next 10 years.
That's right.
And so now what I've also found out is this transmission issue and whether we afford renewables, because many of the better sites for development of renewables are not immediately adjacent to the rail belt. So what I'm part of this geothermal debate and wind wave and tidal power issue is, what are the costs for the transmissions? Can we invest in that? And, you know, what sort of legislation we're going to need to ensure that we invest in the transmission systems and renewables as opposed to being dependent for the next 40 or 50 years on natural gas.
Okay, Tom, I want to hold you up just to let Chris interject here if he wants to.
Sure. Well, I think the caller's right that we have a choice before us, and that choice is going to happen relatively soon, and it is going to be a 40 or 50-year choice. The one caution that I would have with the gas line is even if we get it, we can't, again, control the price of that gas. So the price of that gas is going to keep going up over time. There has been a study called the Rail Belt Electrical Grid Authority study going on for about the last year that the rail belt utilities have been involved in. And that's moving closer towards having some consolidation for planning, at least, of generation and transmission. And there's an integrated resource plan that's being put together here real soon to look at what the resources and the transmission system for the rail belt is going to be, because you're right. We are going to have to make those decisions relatively soon.
Okay, Tom, I sensed you didn't get to your bottom line. I have one more caller I want to get in, though. So, Tom, you there?
Yeah. I could prattle on about this for hours. So if you need another caller, go for it.
All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks, Tom. Tom really, really does his homework. Let's go to Richard, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Richard.
Yeah, hey, Steve. Hi, Chris. Hi, Bracken. Hey, my comment's for Chris. I know you'll be looking at the different projects that are going to be going on in terms of more sustainable energy. You guys know that we got basically two monopolistic, more or less, utility companies here in Southeast. And APLC lets them raise their rates willy-nilly, whatever they want to do. I just hope that you'll take into consideration when you do, when these projects do come online and the investors are all lined up to do their work, just take into consideration and think about not letting these two utility companies have the major control of the systems so that, they can exert their hegemony over us anytime they want to. And that's just a comment for you, Chris.
Okay, well, you know, it's not Renewable Energy Alaska Project that has any jurisdiction over that. I think that you ought to write your legislator and write the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, because those are the folks who have some control over those issues.
Yeah, Richard.
Let me just say there's sort of a broader point, though, here, which comes down to renewable energy and efficiency and the effect on rates. And we have seen globally there has just been a spike in demand for energy resources, whether it's oil or natural gas or coal. You know, Appalachian coal here on the East Coast has gone up 200% in the last year or so. So the price of the fossil fuels that we use to get energy from is spiking. And one of the benefits of renewable energy and energy efficiency is that they can help reduce demand and they can help moderate price in a way that very little else can right now when we're so constrained on supply. So these sorts of investments that are going to take place, a lot of them locally, you know, in bringing more renewables online, helping to cut energy use, really can, over the long term, help stabilize prices for consumers and make people less dependent on utilities. And the caller before was talking about the desire to have just personal control over his resources. And it's a sentiment I really understand right now. One of the things that's really exciting about renewable energy is it actually, it lets you be your own utility. You put a solar panel back on the roof. If you have net metering, you can run your electric meter backwards and sell your energy back into the grid. And
oh, boy, don't let us get started on that one. Oh, boy, I don't want to go there. I don't want to go to that.
That's because we don't have net metering, Bracken.
Yeah.
Yeah. I understand, but getting these policies right is critical because you know, we need a national policy that allows citizens to generate energy and to seek the cleanest, most efficient supplies that are possible.
All right,
you know, critical.
Bracken, that was fun. Let's say you had control of the $45 billion permanent fund of Alaska. Where would you invest it?
Well, I think there is no single silver bullet here. You know, it's more like we need buckshot. We need everything we can get. The caller before was talking about choices between natural gas and electricity. If you look at those two resources nationally, I think the demand for both is only going to grow. Cars are going to move increasingly away from oil, and that's going to be a mix of electrification through these new plug-in electric hybrid vehicles. It's going to be increased use of natural gas as a fuel to displace oil, and it's going to mean advanced biofuels, the next generation of ethanol.
All right, and I'm
so,
sure,
you know,
the list goes on.
We need a broad-based approach.
All right. Chris Rose, thanks so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Steve.
It's obviously an inexhaustible subject, and we'll be back to it. Well, talk of Alaska next week. We're gonna visit with the new chancellor of the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. It's Duncan Moon, our managing editor, Gooseberry Peter at the controls, Emily Butler on the phones, and I'm Steve Heibel. Thanks for listening.